clarity of thinking wasn't the best. And I'm looking down at the mouse and I'm wondering, why is my hand not moving that mouse? My hand is floating above it. I couldn't grip it and I couldn't move it. And I felt fairly fuzzy in my head and knew something was wrong.
Welcome to The Gab, a fortnightly podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thank you once again for clicking and downloading. This is episode 8. Being a quick thinker is part and parcel of a wedding photographer, but fast had a whole new meaning for John McMahon in November of 2016. Then in his mid-40s, while working on his office computer, his faculties started to fail him. Things that were so simple started to become very difficult indeed. His journey was just beginning. Follow John and his wife Elaine as the green glow of traffic lights guided them through the most important hour of John's life. I'm sitting in the kitchen here with two wonderful people, with John and Elaine McMahon. And John, you may know John very, very well. John is a wonderful photographer, an award-winning photographer, both wedding and portrait. And, of course, a great musician as well. And his wife, Elaine, is joining us here as well because she's very involved in the story we're about to tell. Where life, very normal life, busy with kids, running, racing, doing the bits and pieces, can all come to a halt very, very quickly. John and Elaine, thanks a lot for taking the time to have a chat with me today.
Thanks so much for coming, Ronan.
First of all, John, I'll start with you. Life before, obviously, that life-changing day. Tell us about that. It was busy, small kids in the house.
It was. We've an active house. We have three kids. And the day we had a small fright, it was the 5th of November, it was a Saturday. And it was ironic that it was my first Saturday off in possibly 7 months. The job that I'm in, I do wedding photography, and weekends, Fridays and Saturdays are always booked. But it was a mental couple of months, and I also do a bit of school photography. So October, November is just a woefully busy time for me to stay on top of things. And so on that particular day, Elaine was bringing the three kids into the cinema, and I was in bad, bad form because I couldn't go. I had so much work to try and get on top of. And I was doing a job for a colleague as well that afternoon. But Elaine took the three kids into the cinema in town. And I'm upstairs and I'm doing a small bit of editing on the computer. And all of a sudden, I just didn't feel right. I got this, which was unusual, I believe, for someone that has a stroke. But I got a ringing sensation in my ears, and my right hand wouldn't work. I'm there and I'm trying to hold the mouse, and you know, my judgment wasn't the best, or my clarity of thinking wasn't the best. And I'm looking down at the mouse and I'm wondering, why is my hand not moving that mouse? My hand is floating above it, but I couldn't grip it and I couldn't move it. And I felt fairly fuzzy in my head and knew something was wrong. So after a couple of minutes, and I was there for a couple of minutes just looking at my hand and looking at the mouse, wondering why it wasn't working, I decided that I didn't feel great. I had this pain developing in the back of my head. And I said, maybe I should go downstairs and have a look at the colour of myself and see how I look in the mirror. And when I went to stand up, I went flying to my right-hand side. The power in my leg wasn't really there, and the hand wasn't working. So I knew I was in trouble. But I managed to, where my office is, it's upstairs above the studio here, I managed to crawl down on my backside, and I got into a mirror and I had a look at myself, and I didn't look too good. And you know, that particular day, as I said, my clarity of thinking wasn't all that great. I had periods where I could think, you know, acutely, and I had areas where I was like a man that had a heap of drink inside him and just didn't know what was going on. So I had a look and knew it wasn't well. But for some reason, I decided to climb back up to this upstairs to the office again and sit in front of my computer. And I had it in my head that if I could go back and put my hand over the mouse, that I was like going back into a time machine, that everything was going to be pre-okay. Everything was going to be okay like it was 10, 15 minutes before that. And so I went back up and I tried to work away on my computer again, and my headache was getting worse and I was just in bad shape. And I knew I need to do something about this. So luckily enough, I could use my left hand, and I gave Elaine a phone call. Elaine was at the cinema with the kids. So the phone rang out, and Elaine rang back a couple of minutes later, and Elaine, possibly like a lot of mothers, like she knew that I knew she was at the cinema, and she sent a text. She says, is everything okay? You know, I'm at the cinema. And she was probably thinking that, like, John McMahon is making another one of these phone calls, as it's, where is something? Nothing is lost in our house until Elaine can't find it. And she possibly thought it was one of those phone calls. So she texted me and she just said, everything okay? You know, I'm at the cinema. So I texted her back, call me. And she knew something was up. So when Elaine called me back then, my speech was all over the shop. You know, I was very deep voice, and again, going back to, like, you know, like a man that had a load of drink inside him, I couldn't really speak, and I was able to try to tell her that something was wrong with me. So at least we alerted someone to that. So Elaine was fairly quick in ringing a friend of ours, Liam Donoghue, who works up in Headford, not too far from us. And I managed to ring John Murphy on my phone. During this time, Elaine says, "I'm coming home. I'm going to ring Liam Donoghue now. If you can, ring John Murphy, and we'll try and get someone to have a look at you." So I was lucky enough. I managed to ring John Murphy, and he didn't recognise me on the phone. Like, we're best buds. We work an awful lot with each other. And he didn't recognise who he was speaking to on the phone. And I said to him that it was me and I wasn't in good shape. Tried to tell him that. And he says, "I'll be with you in 2 minutes." And fair play to him. He was on his way to do another job, and he did a U-turn. He came back to me. So just between the jigs and the reels, anyway, I started thinking to myself, I wonder, is this a stroke? I can't, you know, my speech is bad. My hands aren't working. My foot, you know, it wasn't working properly either. And small bit scared, and was small bit like, you know, what's going on here?
And was it the right hand and the right foot that was kind of letting you down? Was it that side of your body?
It was the right side that was letting me down, Ronan, and like the speech then as well. And of course, I felt punch drunk, and then I felt sober, and then I felt drunk. And, you know, I was three Nicola, for want of a better expression. So one thing that John came very quickly, and my friend Liam Duggan, and they knew I wasn't in great shape. So they actually tried ringing the doctor, and the doctor says, you know, ring Westock. So we rang Westock, and in retrospect, mightn't have been the best thing to do if somebody is having a stroke or a heart attack, for that matter. The best thing to do is just get straight into the hospital as quick as you can. We would have spent the lads, John and Liam, would have spent 15 or 20 minutes on the phone answering questions, repeating, you know, answers to questions, and eventually they just said, "Listen, let's get going with this lad." So they actually rang Elaine, and Elaine was on her way out of Galway, and Liam Donoghue brought me into Elaine. We met on the Kerr line, which was a fairly traumatic experience for my kids,
of course, yeah.
Because Elaine was bringing the kids home, and they were in the middle of watching a movie in the cinema, and all of a sudden the new dad wasn't well. Elaine had to throw them into a car, and she needed to collect me, bring me into the hospital, and Liam Donoghue took our kids back here. But I wasn't in good shape. My voice was all over the place. And, you know, even though I hadn't a massive clarity of thinking when I met them, I could see the fear in their eyes. I remember poor old Lauren started crying. And Colin was fairly similar. Getting emotional myself now even thinking about this. But anyhow, Elaine took me into the hospital, and the kids came back here, and their sister, their aunt came and collected them. But things went really well for me from then on in. You know, I remember I was in the passenger seat of the car, Elaine bringing me into the hospital, and I had this terrible pain at the back of my head. And the only thing I could do was lie back in the chair, hoping that it would alleviate some of the pressure. So we got to the hospital. Elaine parked directly outside A&E. She parked in the yellow boxes. You know, we were treating this as an emergency. And we dumped the car there. We got inside, and there was three or four people in a queue in front of us. And this is another like thing that went right for me. I'm in the queue, and Elaine is kind of holding me because I'm struggling to stand up by myself. And there's a paramedic. I don't know who he is or what his name was. Never got it from him. But he was sitting down to have a coffee in the A&E kind of reception area. When you come in, you have a person there that takes your details and stuff like that. They give you a card and they bring you down to tell you to drop that into the triage nurse where she's working. But this paramedic sat down and he had a cup of coffee in his hand, and I could see him kind of telling the lady, you know, I'm due this coffee. I've been working hard all morning. I'm well due this. And he put his feet up and he took a sip out of the cup of coffee, and he kind of had his back to me, but he turned over his shoulder and he looked at the queue to see what was going on for the girl he was having the chat with. And I could see him putting his eyes up to heaven as in, "Oh God, my coffee's gone." And he just put the eyes up to heaven. He dropped his coffee and he came outside and he said to Elaine, "Bring that man straight in here." So he obviously spotted something on me that wasn't well, you know, that things weren't good. And, you know, normally when you go into A&E, you have to, you know, answer a few questions. Who's your GP? Where do you live? Your PPS number, all of that. All of that was skipped. We went straight down to the triage nurse, and the paramedic says to the triage nurse, "I need you." And I remember saying something, she said something back to him like, "I'm busy, I'm looking after someone." And he says, "No, I need you here now." So she looked at me and she says, is this man having a stroke? And he said, I think he is. So all of that happened within 60 seconds of arriving at the hospital. You know, things couldn't have gone any better for us than they did. So the triage nurse decided to call Professor Martin O'Donnell, who's an absolute legend and a genius in my own eyes. He was on call that day for anybody that had a stroke in Galway Hospital. And while we waited, she said, let's get him straight down for a CAT scan, as in let's get me straight down for a CAT scan. And she said, we're not even going to wait for a porter, Lane, my wife, you know, you and this man here, we're going to bring John down. So I went straight down, got a CAT scan done, and they had me back in the what's the unit called, the emergency unit in A&E. I was back in that unit, I'd say, within 5 or 6 minutes, and only a couple of minutes later then, Professor Martin O'Donnell came in and he started talking to me, and we were doing a few tests, and they do cognitive tests with you to define, you know, if you are or if you're not having a stroke. The CAT scan that they did on me, the results showed that something was happening, but they weren't 100% sure if it was a stroke or bleed to the brain or what kind of...
Or even a clot maybe, yeah. Or something like that, yeah.
And an MRI scan tells an awful lot more, but the CAT scan let them know that something was wrong. So we started doing some tests, and I could positively do all of the tests they were asking me to do, Ronan. I was lying back in the hospital bed, and, you know, they'd ask you to close your eyes and they'd get you to extend your hands out and bring your hands up and touch your nose. And I could do all of that fine. But they knew something was up at the same time. My speech was all over the place, and they couldn't really, a lot of the time they couldn't comprehend what I was saying, and it was up to Elaine, you know, to try and translate what I was doing. But the next thing he did is he gave me a biro, and he says, do me a favour and write your name there. And the most bizarre thing ever, I'm just looking at a piece of paper and I'm looking at the biro and I can't, you know, I know how to spell my name, I know how to write my name, but my hand won't move. And he says, sure, even, you know, he held up a piece of paper and he says, write this sentence here. And I couldn't write anything, nothing was coming. And I remember getting awful frustrated. And, you know, he told us about a thing that can be done. You can get thrombolized. And basically what that is, it's an injection that someone can get when they have a stroke, and it can clear the clot, if it is a clot. The other downside to that is if it's not a clot that a person has and it's a bleed to the brain that they're having, it's unfortunate that you can write a person off if you decide to give them thrombolize them. But, you know, it was an extremely difficult conversation for Elaine to have because, you know, less than an hour before that, she's in the cinema and she's watching movies with my kids or our kids. And all of a sudden we're talking to a doctor about, will we do this or won't we do this? And Professor O'Donnell was just so, like, I'm very conscious of the fact that this is a professor that was minding his own kids on a Saturday, having his own day off. And all of a sudden he had to cope with the problem of dumping his kids somewhere, and he had to come into me and he had to deal with me. But I couldn't get over how invested he was in us, in me and Elaine, and how patient he was with, you know, helping us come to a diagnosis of what will we do, you know. So I knew my speech wasn't bad, or my speech was bad. And I know that my work, even though I'm a photographer and I press, I'm hiding behind a camera and I press shutters, 90% of what I do is psychological. 90% of what I do is communicating with people and talking to them and try and help them feel at ease and try and help them feel oblivious that they're having a photograph taken. And if I can't talk to people, I can't work. And I try to, in some shape or form, relay that to Elaine. And given the fact that we had gotten into the hospital relatively quickly, Professor O'Donnell was of the illusion that, you know, it's a good time. The earlier you get this injection, you know, the more successful it is, John. And, you know, between the jigs and the reels, we came to the conclusion that maybe we should try and do this. Maybe we should try and get this injection. So I remember Professor leaving us for a couple of minutes, and the nurse came along and she was prepping me for it. And she kind of said under her breath, where nobody else could hear, she was saying, do you realise what you're going to get in? Is there a need to do this? And it put the fear of God in me, you know. And all of a sudden, you know, initially I'm just waiting for an injection in my arm, or I'm waiting for the strip to be fed into it. But now I'm wondering, like, is this something like on death row where they're going to be putting something into me and I could be wrote off, you know. But again, I'm drifting between clarity of thinking and then almost punch drunk and oblivious to what's taking place, you know. But poor old Elaine had to deal with all of this as well. And when that lady made that comment to me, I remember saying to Elaine, maybe you should call my parents. And maybe in the back of my head it was, you know, this might be good night, Irene. This might be a goodbye or whatever. I don't know. I can't put any proper analysis on it, but I asked Elaine to call my parents. And luckily enough, shortly after that, they thrombolized me. I got that injection and got violently sick after you get it. I had a pair of jeans on me, Ron, and I had a t-shirt on or a shirt on me. And I remember saying to Elaine, oh my God, I think I'm after wetting myself. And it was okay. Just the sweat that came out through me.
Yeah.
I was getting sick so much and I didn't know where I was, what was going on. But luckily enough, after about 20 minutes, half an hour, there was no adverse reaction to it. And Professor O'Donnell was pretty happy to leave me alone. He'd come back and see me the following morning. And he left it at that. And we were just basically waiting to get a room then in St. Anne's stroke unit after that. But a pretty traumatic, all right, couple of hours, so it was.
And even, obviously, we learn about the fast situation with strokes and the face. We know about the arm. We know about the speech and everything else. Did anything happen to your face? Did you feel that numbness, John, or...?
My face was actually fine. And this, I suppose, like one of the nurses, the triage nurse, felt there was a droop there. But, you know, ironically, I have a scar on my face that from a melanoma that was removed years ago. So I felt there was organically, yeah, like a droop there. And possibly she saw that. But I didn't feel a numbness. And going back to what I mentioned, the exercise that they ask people to do, Ronan, and this is great for you or for anybody else to know, that if you're ever wondering if anybody is having a stroke, there's a couple of very basic tests you can do. Ask them to close their eyes and just have their arms out as if they're an airplane. And if one hand goes down, you know, they're suffering on one side. The other thing is, like I said, extend your arms out as if you're an airplane and just close your eyes and bring in your hand up to your nose and try and touch your nose. You know, I could do that stuff, but they're tests that people normally failed if they were having a stroke. But I didn't fail them, I passed them. But, you know, the fact that I couldn't write my name, the fact that I could hold a biro but just not write anything, they knew something cognitive, there was something up there as well, you know.
Yeah, but apart from panic as well, John, because I'm sure panic sets in, because not only are you thinking of yourself who's going through this at the moment, you're thinking of your wife, you're thinking of your kids, you're thinking of your future. All this is going through your head at the same time as you're trying to save your life. Was there a situation where you thought that you were speaking to people properly, but they couldn't understand you? Was there that time where you were kind of going, but I'm speaking to you and you're not answering me here?
Definitely. I was speaking to Professor O'Donnell and he couldn't understand me. And I remember letting the odd F word out of me and I'd look at Elaine and Elaine would explain it. Elaine could comprehend what I was trying to say and you know, but I knew myself, Ronan, that there are some people that suffer from that, where they think they're totally legible and they're speaking, you know, efficiently and stuff like that, but nobody else can understand them. I wasn't like that. I knew I was drunk. My voice was very deep. It was very, you know, but I was just slurring words. It was like I had three or four tongues, you know, a swollen tongue. But
and was it down as a TIA, John? Because obviously the transient idea, was it pretty much diagnosed as that?
That's what it is now. That's what they say afterwards. But they still, to this day, I'm in the hospital regularly for checkups. Dr. Rory Waters and Professor O'Donnell look after me. They still can't tell me. Like I was in hospital for a week. And I was awful lucky where I live. They decided that I'd benefit greatly from coming home and getting all my recovery at home. So on a daily basis, I had speech and language people, I had occupational therapists. I had loads of people calling to me for a couple of weeks afterwards and I was able to get through the therapy at home. But to this day, they still can't put their finger on why or how it happened. My bloods were really, really good, which is bizarre. I'm a man that's always carried weight. And I thought, you know, after the stroke, I gave myself a really, really, really hard time. You know, the stress that I caused everybody, the stress that I caused Professor O'Donnell on his day off, the stress in particular for Elaine was just, if the shoe was on the other foot, I don't think I'd ever be able to function like she functioned that particular day.
But it's amazing what kicks in. You know, there's a natural reaction, obviously, as a mom, of course, and as a wife who loves her husband. There's a natural reaction kicks in. It's like anything. When you have to do something, you do it.
Exactly.
I think. Elaine, I'll just bring you into your mic a little bit closer there now, and we'll just have a chat. I'll give John a rest for a second. Obviously, you got that phone call. What went through your head?
Yeah, well, like you said, first the phone was ringing, I did think, oh God, what's he looking for now? You know, so I did text and say, what's wrong? And then when he said, call me, I left the cinema and walked out to the lobby. And for some reason, my legs went like jelly because I knew there was, I just felt something wasn't right. So when I got through to him and he said, there's something wrong, I don't know what's after happening to me. It was an awful experience because he did sound desperate, like he was slurring his words. And it was very, he couldn't put his finger on it, but he said, I'm not right. And he just kept saying, can you come home to me? Can you come to me? And the funny thing is, you know, a few people have said to me since, did you never think of ringing an ambulance? But it never entered my head about an ambulance. So I ran back into the cinema and I made a sign to the kids to come on and got out to the car. And I was thinking, which direction will we go? You know, what's the quickest way to get out the Headford Road? And being a Saturday then, there was cars and trailers and everything on the Curragh line, and I was panicked trying to get down, but I did get through. I got Lauren to ring Liam Dunhu, and I knew Liam was on his way down. And then fair play to John Murphy, he rang to say, we're here with him, you know. Mm-hmm. So I knew at least there was somebody with him. And then they kept in touch with me and we made the plan that we'd meet, you know, en route. It would be the quickest way to get him back in. So like John said, Liam took the kids and my sister came here to them. But it was very traumatic when we met, you know.
And the conversation on the way down the car, because obviously you more than likely have spoken about this along the line. How do you deal with three kids in a car that know the seriousness of what's going on? How did you deal with that? The 20 minutes or 25 minutes?
Yeah, I just kept saying to them, you know, it'll be fine. You know, it'll be fine. Dad probably needs to go into the hospital. Mm. You know, a lot of the time was on the phone, really. You know, the calls kept coming in and out. And they were crying. The kids were crying in the car. And I kept saying, you know, it'll be fine. And my priority was just to get as far as John and get him into the hospital, you know. Mm. So when we met just near Curranduala. We were there for a while before they arrived, and you know, when Liam was helping him out of the car, like, he was in bad shape, you know, he found it hard to stand. We had to link him into my car, and they were bitterly upset, you know. And my sister Barbara had rang her, and she was in Ballinrobe, and she came here, and she was here just shortly after Liam dropped them, so at least I knew that she was with them. Yeah. But my priority then was to get John in. You know, I knew they were okay, even though they were awful upset, but I knew at least she was with them. And like he said, then everything went in our favour all the way in. You know, the lights were all green. It was the opposite to when I was coming out. It was funny. You know, I struggled to get out, and then on the way in, the road seemed to be clear. But John kept asking me, how's my colour? And his colour wasn't good. You know, he was grey. But like you said, I parked in the ambulance bay and we linked him in. And, you know, even rolling down to the first person, I think he was a car park attendant. And when they were bringing John in straight away, I said to him, oh God, I think I'm parked. You know, I might be blocking traffic out there, blocking ambulances. And he said, don't worry about that. You go in with your husband. He said, give me your car keys and I'll move your car. You know, and even that was huge. You know, just the kindness.
Yeah, the positivity was going forward all the time.
And just, you know, even that was, it might seem small, but that was huge. And
your contribution to this earth wasn't done, John.
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't done.
Yeah.
We needed more.
Yeah, so.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but like from that minute on, I mean, Professor O'Donnell, I can't say enough about that man. You know, when he came, he was so reassuring and he was just so down to earth and so kind. And, you know, he made me feel very much as his equal. You know, when he spoke to me, like, he was saying, what do you think? And what do you think we should do? And, you know, I was saying, God, like, I don't know. You know, I'll go whatever you think. Mm. So it was a hard decision, but thankfully it was the right one,
The right one, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, John, that day you were on parallel lives, yourself and the professor.
Yeah.
He was with his family. And he was called in to help you. You were pretty much with your family. You needed the help.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how worlds collide. Yeah. Like
it is.
That.
And if there's one thing that's come out of that, Ronan, like, I would have considered, I invested myself in my job. I used to consider that I was okay at, you know, giving people, you know, a good service or whatever. And this whole episode made me realize that I'm absolutely not on the scale that these guys are. Like Professor O'Donnell, who looked after me, his buddy Rory, Dr. Rory Waters. I was brought up to the stroke unit, St. Anne's unit that night, And the care that I got, and I had never, although I had been in the hospital for short periods of time before, I was never in for anything serious. And for strangers, and that's what they were, strangers to invest themselves in you and your recovery. You know, they owe you nothing. You owe them nothing. But like Deirdre, Michelle, the nurses that were there, Brendan, Mary, like they totally invested themselves, Ronan. The following morning, that night when I was up in the St. Anne's ward, like Elaine had to go off and do some shopping, bring me in some, get me some night clothes and stuff like that. And I don't know if I ever said it to you, but like you brought them there for me, and I think I put them into the cupboard beside me, and I never used them, even though I needed them that night. But I was in bad shape that night, and then during the night, there's a chance that you might have a second stroke. So they put these things on your legs, and they basically keep the blood flowing, you know.
They're like support stockings, aren't they?
It's kind of, yeah. They're electric, and you know, you can feel them moving. Mm. But then every hour, you get a test. The nurse will come over, and you know, you have the resistance exercises, you know, your left leg, push it up, John, right leg, arms, and then they shine the light into your pupils, into your eyes, and that goes on all night long. So I didn't get enough of sleep that night, but the following morning, one of the doctors that was over A&E the previous day, they always have a doctor that's over A&E, but they might even though I had a stroke, the doctor that was over A&E had nothing to do with strokes and wouldn't have known an awful lot about it. But he came up to me the following morning to see how I was doing. And because I had a lack of no sleep, basically, I was really, really, really tired. But my speech was really, really bad, really, really bad. And I was trying to ask him, will my speech get better? And it took me saying it to him four or five times. And he didn't give me an awful lot of hope in his answer. And he was saying that sometimes people recover, sometimes people don't. More often than not, they don't. And they're like, my world collapsed in a sense that, geez, I have no work if I can't, you know.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget, the doctor went off, and I'd never seen him again. But not long after he went, I had a bit of a meltdown, and I just started sobbing, bawling, crying in the bed. And Mary, Mary just came over, pulled the curtains around, came over and held my hand as if she was my mother. And she said, John, what you're experiencing now is just, it's natural. It's all good, you know. And I was bitterly upset. And she was just so good to me. And I suppose at a time where I was lonely and I had no one, it was so, so nice for, again, a stranger that owes me absolutely nothing to be that reassuring figure and just, you know, hold on to me as such. And everything is grand. And she was so, so good to me. And it was unfortunate then that the kids came in. It fortunate and unfortunate. It was great to see the kids that afternoon, but I was actually possibly in worse shape that Sunday than I was the previous day because I had no sleep. Mm. So Elaine had a hard time with them on Sunday night after they came in for the visit. When they got home, they were more traumatised, I think, than they were the previous day, you know.
Well, Mary, the night before, like when I told her how upset the kids were, you know, this Mary, I can't say enough about her. She was so lovely to me and to us. But she, you know, she said, you know, it's very important that you'd bring the kids in tomorrow to see John. You know, she said, I think that's very important. So they arranged that we'd be in at 11:30 before, you know, visiting ours. So we had to stop in Smith's on the way in. Colin wanted to bring in a bobblehead Star Wars for Dad because they're mad into Star Wars, and we had to do that en route. And when we went in, like John, as he said, he was very tired and his speech was, you know, was bad, and it was very tough on them, you know, it really was. They were devastated.
And even the conversation on the Saturday night after you coming back, because you presumably came back to the house.
Yeah, I did,
What was the mood in the room?
You know, they were very upset, Ronan. Like, they were bitterly upset. And I'm even getting emotional thinking of it now. But, you know, I was trying to reassure them as good as I could. You know, that Dad's in the right place and he'll get the help and he's got this injection now. And, like, every day he'll be getting better. But, I mean, I was saying this to them and I really didn't know myself if that was the truth.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, family were great. Like, I can't stress enough, like, they were the support I got from them all that week. And every day the kids were brought in, you know, and they'd bring them in and they'd bring them home, and they'd, you know, had plenty of Supermax and stuff for the week just so I could be with John as much as possible. And that was great. But I mean, that Sunday was really tough. And I remember poor Liam, he was 12 at the time. He was crying bitterly when we came out. It was a short visit now. My sister collected them then. And I said, you know, what's upsetting you the most, Liam? And he said, he doesn't seem like Dad, you know, and that was hard. But, you know, every day then, you know, that we'd go in, John was picking up after that. And it was good for them to see him, you know, it was important. And it was good for John to see them as well, you know.
Of course it is. And I personally know you both as well. And I know how close you are as a family. And I know how close John is to the two boys. Mm. So it had to have been really traumatizing for everybody involved on that. Right, let's speak about brighter, sunny days when you started to recover and things started to go your way again, a bit like the traffic lights heading into Galway. When did you notice an improvement, John?
Well, I'd say almost daily I could see an improvement in my speech. Like this happened the first week in November, Ronan. I actually shot a wedding at the end of November, much to the annoyance of the doctors and the nurses. Like I had the stroke on the 5th of November, and on the 12th of November, the following Saturday, I was meant to be doing our friend Dave Cooley's wedding.
Yeah, and Dave.
Like, as far as clarity of thinking, I told you when we were in the ward and I was getting thrombolyzed, I says, "Bring my, you know, let my parents know I'm here." I remember my dad coming in, and I remember giving my dad my phone, and I says, "This is like bizarre," but I remember giving him my phone. I was saying, "Dad, ring Dave, tell him I can't do his wedding next week, and I'm going to be in hospital." That's how stupid it was. I was not thinking about myself, but you know, thinking and my recovery, but thinking about everybody else. But all the, I spent a week of getting tests in the hospital and massive, massive, massive support. And on a daily basis, I could feel myself getting better. There's certain things that I still have problems with, even back to the handwriting. Unless I write at the speed of somebody that's in junior infants, I can't write. There's many a time there where I might be doing a Zoom call with somebody and I might try and write a note down. And even though I might look at the note and it makes sense because it's fresh in my mind, if I look at it a day later, I have no idea what I'm after writing. So that has always kind of never improved itself. For the drumming, I used to be a drummer, and I used to be lucky enough and do gigs, but I can't do that anymore. So there's one or two things that just never came back. On the great scheme of things, it's been absolutely brilliant, and my rate of recovery was really, really fast. I kind of even feel guilty now talking about my handwriting or not being able to drum, because, you know, as I've alluded to you before this, like, my scars from the stroke are minuscule. You know, and I've unfortunately had friends since that have had strokes, and they have, you know, their life has just really been turned upside down. So, you know, in ways I feel guilty that I'm talking about it when I've had a success in the way I've come out of it. But there's no harm in letting people know that, you know, success can come of a stroke as well if you get prompt treatment. If you're lucky enough and you can get to a hospital as quick as I did that day, if you're lucky enough that you have someone of the competence of Professor Martin O'Donnell to work with you and, you know, thrombolize you. And, you know, I know I've alluded to it already about doctors and nurses, like, but that St. Anne's unit and just the way everybody, like, being a nurse in those units isn't a job, it's a vocation. Those people aren't just clocking in the hours, clocking in and clocking out. You know, I remember speaking to one of the girls, Michelle, and, you know, I've ended up doing an awful lot of their weddings, bizarrely. I've done shot a lot of their weddings, and then they've had kids and they've come here and I've shot the kids, and it's such a gift to be able to do it. But I remember speaking to them, and, like, Michelle would often, she'd say her job can be overwhelming at times, and she'd lock herself in with the broom cupboard, she says, and she'd have a good cry. She's looking at what's taking place in front of her, you know. And, like, they're not robots. They have feelings and this, that and the other, like all of us, you know, but they're truly gifted at what they do, and I'm, you know, totally indebted to them. But I'm indebted to them because my recovery has been so good because of them and their investment in me. The doctors and nurses that came out here and gave me the speech and language therapy, they gave me the occupational therapy, they gave me the physio, you know, it was all very good, Ronan. I would have been a week out of hospital, I would have been glass very much full, and so much so they were telling me to slow down in the hospital. I remember one day in November, we parked the car. It was Christmas market was on. We parked the car in Terryland and we walked in, and Elaine was giving out to me saying that's too far a walk to be doing. But I felt great, and, you know, I thought I was invincible. And lo and behold, for two or three days afterwards, I was absolutely snookered. I hadn't got the energy to be doing that. But I was always a glass half full kind of a person. But I'd safely say it would have been the following March or April before I got my faculties back and my energies back to what it was like beforehand.
Yeah, so you're talking roughly 5 months of recovery between the speech and occupational therapy and everything else that goes along with it. Obviously, things have changed. Your views on things have changed. What did you take for granted before you got this, John? Was it our ability or the different abilities that we have? What did you take for granted, do you think?
I don't know great question, because I'm flummoxed at it. But one thing that I do know was that I was so invested in my work that I felt that if I didn't get a particular job done by a particular time, the sun wouldn't rise the following morning. The world would come to an end. I was so invested in work, and I was in such a dark place. So I suppose one thing that has happened is that it has woken me up to that. I reckon I always had a small bit of awareness and gratitude for the wife I have, gratitude for the kids I have, and it didn't take a stroke to wake me up to that. But now all those feelings are magnified 100 times over. You know, I actually cry quite a lot at weddings, bizarrely. I look at fathers of brides and I listen to them give speeches on wedding day, and I'm very cognizant that I don't take for granted I'm going to be around when Lauren walks up, hoping I will be, and I'm optimistic I will be. But I'm listening to these men's speeches and I'm just like, I cry so easily. But I think it's made me, even though I believe I smelled the roses beforehand, I'm smelling them all the time now, and I'm very grateful and alert to all the good things that are happening around. And I suppose the biggest wake-up call was just at work. I always put work and jobs and doing 14, 16-hour days, doing them because that was what required. And like I said, the sun wouldn't get up if I didn't do that. I now realise that's all bunyuk. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That I'm looking after myself an awful lot more than I was. I'm going to an absolutely fantastic gentleman called Andrew O'Shaughnessy. He's a gym over in Carlisle. Via that gym, I'm physically looking after myself an awful lot better than I was. Previously, I was a great walker. Even when I had the stroke, I would have been walking 3-4 times a week. And there's a 9-kilometre kind of walk that I do here. But my buddy John Murphy started going to Andrew a couple of years ago, and he got me going over with him. And I absolutely love that now. I absolutely love that. So, you know, I'm always carrying that, the love handles, they're always there, but I'm a lot fitter and I'm a lot stronger than I ever was, I think, you know.
Because even when I contacted you about meeting up to do the podcast or whatever, you were just after finishing a session. It rang out first and I said, John is doing something. I don't know what he's at. And sure enough, when you got back to me, you were just after a session over in Andrews.
Yeah.
So moving forward, obviously, in the future and all that, are you medicine free now?
No, so I'm on two tablets every day, Ron, and one of them is a blood thinner. And it's a form of aspirin, but it's an extremely small one. I remember going to Dublin a couple of years ago to do a training course, and I was gone for a couple of nights and I forgot my medication. But Elaine sent me on my prescription and I was able to go into a chemist, and I was saying, listen, I'm after forgetting my tablets, but I need blood thinners. That's my prescription. Like, can you sell me aspirin and tell me how much I take? And she looked at it and she came back. She says, yeah, all you need to take is half one of those a night, you know. So I'm on for almost the equivalent of half an aspirin. But I'm also on one for cholesterol, and it's Lipitor or something like that. But it's quite light as well. Like I said, and this, like, it's bizarre that even though I had the stroke, my cholesterol and stuff like that, you know, you'd imagine you would have had high cholesterol and, you know, it was troublesome, and that could have brought on a heart attack or a stroke. Bizarrely, it was all good, you know. I have a small hole in my heart. They discovered that. And, you know, I had blood pressure monitors on for a few days at home. All the signs that are there for, you know, that you need to be careful, they were all pretty much okay, and they have been okay kind of since, you know. It's bizarre.
But, so it can pretty much just show that it can happen to absolutely anybody at any time. That's the crazy thing. Is it hereditary? Is a stroke hereditary?
I think it can be.
Okay.
I read up on it myself. I think it can be. But if it is hereditary, it's down to bloods. Do you know what I mean? And if you've a family history of bad cholesterol, you know, you've certainly have family histories of heart attacks. It's in families and stuff like that. So, like, a heart attack basically is when you have a clot in your heart, and a stroke is basically when you have a clot in your brain. They're not awfully dissimilar, you know. But Dr. Rory Waters reckons it might be a bit of muscle that came off, a piece of tissue that came off a muscle for me, and it just lodged itself up there. But it can run, and it can happen to anybody. And I turned 50 a couple of weeks ago. I was 44, 45 when this happened. Like when you're 20, you think 44, 45 is ancient. But when I'm 50 now, I'm thinking 45 is quite young, you know. Yeah, but it can happen. And you know, Ronan, there was a girl that was after, when I was in the St. Anne's stroke unit, there was a girl that was after finishing a marathon. She was 27, 28 years of age, and she had a stroke, you know. Very fit girl, carrying no weight, you know, looked like a professional athlete. And
yeah. It's just one of those things. It can just happen. Elaine, what did you take from the whole experience?
Well, I mean, I can't say enough about the care he got. I mean, like I said, from the minute that car park attendant took my keys to the day he left, the care was second to none. I mean, we were in and out of the stroke ward all that week. They never once made me feel I was in the way, you know, and they you know, always said, bring in the kids now whenever you need to. And I know once or twice there was somebody very sick in the ward, and they'd pull the curtains around John's bed so the kids wouldn't, you know, witness that. And they never once made me feel I was in their way. They always included me in everything. And I mean, we have Dr. Rory Walsh, as John said, he would have been a previous, yeah, he's a friend of my brother's. He's from the same place I'm from, Curnamona. And I mean, he's a great man to have now. If I have any worries, you know, I'll always say to John, will you give Rory a text? Because I still worry, you know, to this day.
Of course, well, John, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that fear.
Obviously, as time has passed, it's got easier. But I mean, if he complains of a headache or, you know, isn't feeling well, at the back of my mind, I'm thinking, Jesus, this is a sign now, you know. So I'll, you know, I'll always say, you might send Rory a text there, and he'll always reassure him, or he'll say, come in and we'll have a look at you. And it's fantastic to have that support.
But it's amazing how over the last 15 minutes or 20 minutes that we've been speaking about this, how you've spoken about people in their first names. You have built up a huge friendship base through this.
Yeah.
As in, these people are not just professionals that looked after you. They are now friends.
Yeah.
So it just shows the appreciation that ye have for them, that you've nearly followed up on things and kind of got nearly involved in their lives.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
It's not just that, Ronan. And this, I know this sounds like deep, but I want to be a better person in life because of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
When someone invests themselves so much in you, you know, as I said, the way they apply themselves to their jobs, I'm doing that. I'm trying to do that in whatever way I can, as a photographer, as a father, as a husband or whatever. It all stems from them. You know, they're fantastic, fantastic people. And I feel that, you know, if I went into them an unhealthy person, I feel like it's like an insult to them. It's an insult to what they have done for you and the way they've invested themselves. If I wasn't looking after myself, you know, it's like throwing all that back on them, and that wouldn't be an awful nice thing to do. But
yeah, it's fantastic. One thing I just want to go back to for a second. Obviously, people make out, oh, I was getting, there was little messages here and little messages there that I wasn't taking any notice of at the time. Did you notice anything before you got the belt upstairs? Were there little things of you going to a room and you kind of go, why am I here? Why did I come to this room? Was there anything that you noticed before that, John?
No, other than the fact that Ronan and I was awfully under pressure with the amount of work that was done. I think we made reference to it 2 days before I had the stroke. Elaine remembers me coming down here and just holding my head in my hands and thinking, like, how am I going to get through this? I've just so much to get done. And you see, some people might listen to this and say, you fool, you know, just stop. When you're in ways you'll relate to this yourself because you're self-employed. Mm. And, you know, even though Elaine is working, I was kind of, and this is no disrespect to Elaine's job, I was the breadwinner in the family.
Mm.
And there's an urgency to make sure the mortgage gets paid. There's an urgency to make sure that the money is there for the shopping on the Friday or the Monday or whatever. And things have to keep on turning. Now I realise that, you know, I don't need to get as wrapped up as I was beforehand. But I never had any signs of pressure in a sense of feeling ill, feeling sick, feeling under the weather. But I did definitely have signs of, I'm under pressure here mentally and I need to get on top of stuff. And they were the only things, Ronan, that were triggering me, you know. In hindsight, you know, you could look back and say, Jesus, John, like, you were mental for a week or two beforehand. You know, you were trying to stay on top of things. You were juggling a lot of balls. But there was no physical thing, you know. There was no going off getting headaches. Mm. Just like a dart out of the blue, it just hit me. And
that's mad. The joys of an entrepreneur, huh?
Yeah.
You can't beat it. Now, looking back on things, obviously, let's try a bird's eye view here for a second. What would you say to people out there that might be, say, for instance, working up a sweat constantly and worrying about things and all that kind of an idea? I'd say health first, John.
100%. But it's very hard to, when you're wrapped up in doing a job, when you're wrapped up in getting something done for a deadline, or when you're wrapped up in your own little work world, if someone tries to give you advice, if you're not in a healthy position, you won't actually hear them. You might acknowledge them saying, Ronan, will you slow down for God's sake? You will. I will. As soon as I have this job done, I will. That's you know, that's the way you're inclined to carry on. But nowadays I'm not panicking anywhere near as much. I'm able to delegate an awful lot more. I'm not making as much money as I should be, but I'm delegating to other people, and I've a richer life. I would definitely say health wise, especially when I'm now in my 50s, exercise, and like your heart is the only muscle in your body that you can't physically see. So in other words, you're sitting there now, if you held a weight in your arm and for 10 weeks, every day you had a heavy weight and you were going like that. If you look at your arm after 10 weeks, you say, wow, that's pretty toned up. Like the work I'm doing is pretty good. You know, it's happening. But you don't actually see that with your heart. Mm. So I view it exceptionally important to work that via the spinning classes I do with Andrew when he's roaring at us and we've great music on the background, or via lifting weights, you know. But I find it great. And I also find it mentally helps me stay on top of work. I'm a much sharper person as a result of it. I did a wedding 2 weeks ago and I had to be over in Claremorris at 10:30 in the morning. I was over in the gym at 8:00 and did my workout and showered and went straight to there to work. And it was one of the most productive days at work because I was so sharp. But it comes from working out, and it comes from, you know, just feeling good and feeling alive and stuff like that, and feeling alert to things. Very quickly, I have to tell you that when I started going to the gym, I loved it. I loved the music that would be on over there. And I felt I had endorphins when I'd come home of happiness and goodness. And I started saying it to Elaine. And I kept on saying it to her, please, Elaine, if you go to the gym, you'll love it. And the more I said it to her, the more I annoyed her. So I stopped saying it. So I came home one day and she says, so how'd you get on? And I was surprised she asked me. And I says, Elaine, it was absolutely brilliant. And then there was silence and I was doing something. And about 30 seconds later, she says, I think I'll go with you on Saturday. Well, you could have blown me over with a feather, so you could have.
I was sick listening to him, so I said I'd give in.
And I didn't even ask this time, you know, it came from within. But to finish the story, she went that Saturday and it's 20 minutes on the bike and then it's 25 minutes of doing weights and circuit training. And she absolutely loved it. The following Saturday, the Rugby World Cup is on and Ireland were playing Japan. And I said, Elaine, I'm going to have to miss the gym. I'm going to watch the rugby here with the boys. And she went over by herself.
That's the job.
And yeah, I loved it. I loved the spinning and the music. And it's just, it's brilliant, yeah.
But I suppose, and this is a long-winded point I'm trying to make, is that Elaine, who wasn't, you know, the athletic gym type person, and even if you were to look at pictures, it might be a small bit intimidating. She's kind of bought into it herself and she loves it and she feels good when she gets over there and stuff like that. So I'd say anybody that was remotely thinking about it, it doesn't even have to be a gym, be it your walk, be it whatever, but just get that bit of exercise into you. And you know, the walk that we do takes an hour and 20, it takes an hour and 25 minutes possibly. The clarity of thinking you have when it's all over and you feel better, you have a shower and you feel you're able to tackle stuff. So the dangerous years in life, which I feel I'm kind of entering, you know, I'm trying to look after myself as best I can. And that's finding the right combination of work and exercising, you know.
Well, that's fantastic. It really is. And if we learn anything from it, don't ever take anything for granted. Go with it. And time is the most important thing of anything. We all know that from the stroke idea of the F for the face and the A for the arms and the speech, the S, of course, and T, very important time, because time that morning, I feel personally, helped you considerably, that people moved quickly, John. Both your family and your wonderful friends, the two superheroes we were talking about a little earlier on.
Liam and John.
Yeah. So I just want to wish you all the very best. Thanks so much for sharing your story, because it's not easy to share a story, especially when it brings back thoughts and feelings again. But I hope that it helped you as much as it'll help somebody else that's listening to this. And I wish you years of happiness, health, success and everything else. And of course, awards for you, John, because they're coming out your ears anyway for photography. And well done on all you do. And I have to say, John, let's be honest with you. I don't normally get too personal on these podcasts, but I have to say that we had you as our wedding photographer and you were absolutely fantastic at what you did. You loved what you did. And sure enough, the fruits of the labour is up on my wall at home. So I do wish you all the very best. Elaine, thank you very much indeed for the tea and the hospitality and everything else. I never ever leave McMahon's without being well full. So continued success to you all, and thanks very much for inviting me in.
Gentlemen, thanks so much, Ronan.
Not at all, thank you.
Thank you for listening. The next podcast will be available May 5th.